Good morning. It is Danger Dan here in the Talk Shop, and I have got a wonderful show for you today. My guest is Jonathan Tyler, and if you are not aware of him or his music, you should just pause this now. Pull up your YouTube, your iTunes, or however you stream your music these days. He put out an album with Jonathan Tyler, or as Jonathan Tyler in the Northern Lights back in like 2009 or 10. That one's got some amazing songs on it, like Pardon Me or Gypsy Woman, I think, is on that one. Then he did another one about 5 years ago called Holy Smokes, which is an amazing album. What's on that one? What is on that one? River Bottom's on that one. And then he's got a new album out called Underground Forever, and we talk about it in this podcast. There's a lot of things we talk about in this podcast, but I think there's even more stuff that we didn't talk about. You're really going to enjoy it. I'm going to have him back on, which I'm stoked about. I probably was fanboying out a little bit. Man, I really enjoy this guy's music. I mean, it's fucking good. Anyhow, hope you guys had a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. Got to ride some motorcycles, I hope. I left with two motorcycles and came back with three, thanks to J.P. Rodman up there, J.P. Rodman Paintworks in Raton, New Mexico. I really enjoyed hanging out with all my friends this weekend. A bunch of Stampede racers came and met me in New Mexico when we rode around Northern New Mexico. My wife on the back of my chopper. It was fucking beautiful. Can't thank everybody who came and enjoyed the time with me enough. I really, really enjoyed it. But it's time to get to work, y'all. You know, obviously all the dates are kind of in the air. Raton, he's saying there's a chance, but there's also a chance it might happen on Labor Day weekend. So right now it's set for July 16th, 17th, and 18th, but just stay with me here. We'll get some solid news on that eventually. Born Free, September 26th and 27th. We don't have a date for the Southern Throwdown yet, but it's coming. Loretta Lynn's Motorcycle Music Revival in October is still happening. I'm not even sure what the next date is, where I'm going next. But I'm going to be riding a motorcycle soon. This show, like all shows, is brought to you by MC Shop Tees, your T-shirt of the month club. The only way to support every local motorcycle shop. That is right. Go to mcshoptees.com. It's like a magazine subscription, except for you get a badass T-shirt every single month. It's amazing. This month's featured shop is Virus Moto out of Long Beach, California. My friend Mikey Virus, who actually whooped my ass at the Mint 400 race earlier this year, opened up his shop last year. And, man, he does it all. So go find him if you're in California. If you're traveling and you got some problems while you're in California, hit up Virus Moto. He will take care of you. The first shop I ever featured was Brown Cycles out of Dallas, Texas. 50 years old, man, and they've been in business since 1970, family owned and operated. Red Eye's been there for over 20 years. He will actually be racing this weekend at the All Harley Drags. That's where I'll be this weekend, is watching Red Eye race his Sportster. Can't wait to see that. Jake and Scott are both veterans of the Afghan and Iraq War, and two of my favorite people. They recently got a straight shooter tool from Rack and Pull. It's a front end power plant and swing arm alignment with laser precision. They can also assess frame damage if you happen to get in an accident. Go check out Brown Cycles at 5223 Military Parkway. Follow them on the gram at Browns_cycles. Dude, love those guys. All right, so another way you can support this show is by going to DangerDansTalkShop.com. When you get to my homepage, there's a menu tab. You can click on Patreon support, And for as little as a dollar a month, you got a chance at winning a bunch of badass shit. I mean, I give away a knife handmade by Nick every single month. We've been doing this for over 2 years. I can't thank Nick enough. He rode out this weekend and met me in New Mexico. I actually got to take him on some four-wheeling trails all the way up the mountain on the dirt. Nick, you're the man. I'm glad that you made it out and back home safely. I'm sure you're in your shop right now making knives. So if you want to win a knife, go to DangerDanceTalkShop.com. Make sure you're following Nick, too. You don't have to win a knife to get one from Nick. As well as knives, we give away, what else? I've given away T-shirts, hats. Right now, I'm going to give away a Lowbrow Customs gift card and auxiliary fuel tank, which you might need, you know, if you're like me and you like to run out of gas. Let's see, 139 happens to be Liam Fake. Liam Fake. I've never even seen this name before, and there's no address here. But I got your email. I will send you an email. Liam, thank you for supporting the show, man. Dude, a dollar a month may not seem like much, but it adds up. Now, I've got a special giveaway at the end of the year for anybody that pledges $5 a month. For every $5 a month you pledge, dude, you got a chance at winning a trip to Nepal thanks to Bear and Booty of Motorcycle Sherpa. That's right. You can ride the Himalayas on your Himalayan or whatever motorcycle they rent over there. We rode Himalayan, so I'm sure a Royal Enfield of some sort. But we're going to give a trip away to one of you listeners. All it takes is a $5 donation every month, and you got a chance at winning. Go to MotorcycleSherpa.com and check out the expeditions that they offer. It is fucking amazing. If you scroll back, I did a road show while I was over there in Nepal. Hell, I might have used some of Jonathan's music on this, on these road shows. I know I have definitely used some of his music in the past road shows. So thank you, Jonathan. I want to thank all the supporters of the show. High Seas Jerky, Heavy, DCD. Oh, wait a second. We're going to give away a DCD shirt right now to 12. Go to DCDstore.com. Check out what they got. 12, my sister, Rebecca Hardick. You just won a hat from DCD. Beautiful. Check out my sister on the gram at Insta, what is it? Inappropriate Trucker Hats. She's a fucking trip. Uncle Becca. All right, let's get into the show with Jonathan Tyler. Here you go.
Cool. Yeah, so the Outbound Train. I used to play a lot of music. And
you good? You need to
do... I was going
to
get a lighter.
Yeah, do it.
So I got one right here.
Okay, well, then we're good.
No, I left it on that chair with my
tobacco.
Well,
I have one right here. No problem.
Yeah, I used to play a lot of music, and I started taking my bike on the road.
Yeah.
With the band.
In the trailer or something?
No, riding it with the guitar and the skateboard.
That's cool.
And it was awesome. But it, like, created this divide in the band. You know, like, I'm on my own. We weren't on the road together.
Like, there wasn't already enough to divide you.
Exactly. So I ended up, like, leaving one tour after some shit happened. And I rode to my buddy's place in East Texas. He had a tattoo shop, played music, and rode bikes. And I was like, hey, I'm not. I'm done with music at this, you know, in this way until I can find a band that all rides motorcycles. And that was like 6 years ago. And we finally did it last year.
Oh, y'all did it?
He was like, we did a Texas tour. We started in Corpus Christi and played shows. Corpus, Austin, Houston... And then played the Southern Throwdown pre-party last year.
Nice.
So we did that, and it was awesome, and he wanted to record an album. And I was like, oh, dude, I've done that before. Studios, like, I was like, how about we just, like, go on a ride and document it?
Yeah.
Set up somewhere cool, play the music, whatever sound we get's the sound we get. So we did exactly that. We went to the Cosmic Shed out in East Texas and
is set that the up ZZ Top studio or is that
no, it's like it's not a studio at all. It's like this place in East Texas this guy built out of trash.
Okay.
While he was working at NASA, just like on his way from East Texas to Houston, he would find trash on the side of the road, bring it back up, and built this crazy four-story building.
With is it out of
art exhibits all through?
Is it the moving boxes, shipping containers?
No. It's these crazy like four giant beams. It's like a big teepee with an overlook up out top.
That's cool. So you guys recorded there, and is that kind of like what's coming out? Or we made a video. Nice.
Yeah, we released it all.
That's
already good,
dude. That's the way
I do
things.
It was fun.
The
whole experience was awesome. We wake up in the morning, ride to the skate park.
I mean, if it's fun, then you're winning.
Yeah, exactly.
Because like, as you do it more and more for a living, it's like it becomes sort of like, it can become less fun, I think. You know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, with any. Like any hobby you try and turn into a job, you know, like,
yeah,
I feel like I do a lot with this podcast to keep it enjoyable for me, you know, like
you have to, or you won't keep doing it.
I don't look at what people want to hear, who they want me to talk to. I talk to people that I want to talk to, you know.
I mean, that's the only way to keep it, you know, in the long run, to keep it fun for you. I mean, it's hard for people on the outside to see that because I think they think, well, if the dollars are there and or the, you know, opportunities there, why not grab that fruit, you mm-hmm. know, from the tree? And it's like, I mean, you can, but it's just a temporary thing, because if you're doing something that you hate, it's not going to last.
No.
I mean, you can do it for a little while, but eventually your subconscious or whatever is going to...
When I feel like some people that do go into it with that mindset still slowly get... It slowly overtakes them, you know, like little things. And
it's
then
hard.
It just,
I mean, it's a daily...
That's what I'm saying. Like, I seem like I'm daily practicing trying to keep this thing fresh.
It is a practice.
And enjoyable.
That's, I think that's like, you know, that's life. It's trying not to be too complacent and getting too stuck in, you know, a rut.
I think that this COVID incident, the pandemic, if you will, has been great for me. It's like a reset, you know.
Yeah.
Got me out of my, you know, regular.
Yeah. I mean, I've been a studio rat for the last 2 years. I kind of slowed down on my touring, and so it's not too much different for me than like what I already was doing, mm-hmm. as far as just recording bands and being in the house in the studio, because my studio's here. So it's not that much different for me. The only part that I'm kind of missing is the social aspect, because usually I hole up in the like a hermit mode for a week, record our album, go out late at night to drink, see people. But now I just kind of drink alone. We're around here at Samstown Point in South Austin, kind of where I'm living here on this commune. We're still hanging out.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a more. I think the COVID thing is a psychological operation, and I think there's a lot more to it than what people think. What they see on the outside. I mean, I think there's a lot of global politics at play, mm-hmm. as far as, well, we don't have to go into politics, but I think there's a lot more to it. And yeah. I think there's a big shifting of the paradox right now. And I think that this is sort of like, it's being used as a way to kind of reshuffle the deck, because everybody's on lockdown and in these positions where it's like, okay, we can change our relationship with China right now. We can, you know, we're not going to import their goods anymore, and they're not going to import ours. We're going to have to start making our own stuff. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to start being careful about who we let control our internet. You know, all these data controllers.
That's the thing, is the information right now. It's like,
it's incredible. And there's never been a time like it. And so I think that's why it is kind of necessary for us to sort of reshuffle the deck, because mm-hmm. times are different. You know, we can't just let this foreign government create our chips and our processors and our Wi-Fi units and in our satellite, you know, our cell phone towers. I mean, it's too easy for those guys to just tap into whoever they want to. And so I kind of think that I do believe that the disease is real, but I think that maybe they're using this time as a way to reconfigure
You think it was intentional, or was it like, hey, look, we've kind of got this opportunity. Let's.
That's the part that, I mean, we'd just be going into conspiracies. Yeah. And I'm 100% believe that those kind of things happen all the time. And so I definitely have ideas about it, but yeah. I don't really, in a public way, I don't go on Twitter or Facebook or anything and propagate any of those ideas because I don't think it's safe to do it without really knowing it's true. I mean, we could sit and talk about it all day long, and I think that that's interesting, especially in a forum where it's not just going to be a soundbite in one sentence taken out of context, you know, like. But when it's a conversation and you can look at the whole conversation to sort of make a point, then I'm okay talking about politics and these sort of things because I just don't want to get put into a left wing or right wing box. I mean, that's the thing that's really causing a lot of the problems in our country is just how extreme everyone is. Well, everyone on the news and in the media. Yeah, I think the more, like when I go out into play shows and hang out and talk to people after the shows and just I'm kind of around all different types of people through playing music, I find that there's a lot of moderate people. Most people are moderate somewhere in the middle, you know, and those are the people that aren't really represented on television. And so it's tough to talk about this stuff because immediately, like, whichever side, you know, a media interviewer or sort of person, whatever they're trying to push, they're going to sort of try to angle or, or cut out just a couple sentences and make it into a. And so I don't really talk about it super like publicly very often, but I, you know, on a one-to-one basis, most of my friends know that I'll go way down a rabbit hole on this kind of stuff.
Well, let's talk about the music in this.
Yeah.
I mean, because you've been through a change in the music industry that was, what, not like this, but I feel like when you guys got going, like back in 2008, 2009, like that was like the music industry was changing big time at that point. You know, like with the internet, people or bands realizing that they can record their own music on a smaller budget. They could get it out there through different means instead of going with the old formula.
Yeah.
Like I had a friend whose band, Green River Ordnance, they got picked up early on. Went on a big tour, and then got away from that, you know, and just used the audience that they had got on the road and started doing stuff on their own.
Yeah, I think that that's a whole other conversation too, because now most of those aggregators, that's what they call the distribution companies that sort of take the music to Spotify, iTunes, all the different platforms that people listen to stream music on. Those have all been bought up now by the same, companies.
Okay, yeah.
So there was a window of time when those small aggregators, when they first came out, like CD Baby is one that a lot of people use, and TuneCore is one that a lot of people use, and there's a bunch of others. But my point is that those companies have since been acquired by different big money people. So it's not as like free as it was in that time. There was a time where it was like the internet kind of blew it all open. But as soon as that happened, you know, the big money investment companies and funds, they just buy these companies and sort of control them just like they were controlling them in the 90s.
That's interesting, yeah.
I mean, that's how I see it. I still believe that there's a way to break through. But, I mean, we all know that these social media, you know, Facebook is doing what they call where they put like a gauge on a post. So when you make a post, it's only going to show it to a certain amount of people that follow you. So at one point, Facebook, you could just post and it would post your thing to all the people who followed you. But now they've sort of put this, and they're calling it something, and I hate that I'm spacing out on what they're calling it, but they put a
You're not thinking algorithm.
Well, it like is an algorithmic thing, but they're slowing things down.
So like not all your followers are seeing what you post.
Not even close. Not even, I would say 5%. You have to pay to get people to see other stuff now. So like YouTube, it's the same way. I mean, there was a time where it was totally free and you could post something, but now it is being shaped by who's paying for their stuff to be seen. And I think that everybody's gonna know what I mean when they,
yeah,
because there was a time where Instagram wasn't like throttled. That's kind of the key word.
Well, I remember a lot of businesses at one point were all like, "Go follow, when you follow us, click some other things to make sure that you do see our posts."
I mean, it makes sense. These guys, they start a free company for everybody to sign up for free. People get on, the people that get on and post their stuff are what makes the thing interesting. And so it grows because it has this freedom and this interesting aspect to it. And then once it's hit a certain level, they change it and turn it all against everyone. So it's like, okay, now you want to make, if you're
now that there's value in this, you see the value.
You have to pay for it.
Yeah.
So it's tricky. So I'm not trying to say, like, I don't want to come off as being like a negative type person or anything like that.
It's just the way it is.
I'm just trying to be really like honest about what happens, like from my perspective, whenever I'm putting out a new song or like releasing something, I can tell that, you know, it's throttled. And I think that everybody knows that now.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, what's going to be the next thing as far as like, because people just move on. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that it's like, they'll just move on to another thing. So I don't know what it is yet, but I think that they'll move on from working.
What's interesting is podcasts have not been monetized through like iTunes. You know, like there's no, they don't charge you to be on there. It doesn't cost anything. They haven't monetized it for their own gains.
Knock on wood, dude. They're gonna hear.
Oh, they have already heard this talking about.
They heard what we just said. Yeah. It went into the supercomputer and.
But it is interesting that they haven't done that. You know.
I think that it's podcasts are making money for a lot of people. I mean, it's gotten really super popular. I mean, I know I listen to them all the time now. Yeah. So like, I think a lot of people do. So I don't know. I'll be honest. That's a world that I don't know as much about. I can't really speak.
And neither do I. I just keep posting them.
Well, you seem to be doing good. A bunch of my friends have sat down with you, like Greg Giannakis.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Danita.
Greg was a good one, man. I caught him in like an interesting time.
Well, you could always catch him in an interesting time.
Oh, yeah, he was good. I was thinking about him on the way down here. I'd hit him up while I'm in town.
You should. Yeah, I talk to him all the time. He's doing great. He's got like four bikes that are all enviable. And he's just got a real aesthetic and sense of style that I've always loved.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you asked me outside if we'd met, and I was like, no, I'd seen you in concert before. And I'll never forget the first time. It was at some like dive bar outside, like on Lake Worth.
Was that in Fort Worth?
Yeah. It was like after you'd been on tour, came back, and the place was just, it was just nuts, man. It had a bunch of local musicians that you guys brought up and played, and it was just like a big jam session.
And I've been playing so long, well, 15 years or something. So I try to remember specifics, and I'm like, was it one of those nights
like
that
Augies
I don't remember?
Or something? Oh yeah, it probably is. It probably. I mean, I barely remember it. Yeah. I know there was later on that night.
We ended up on at Whataburger, and like Brandon, our guitar player, who we call Kansas when he turns into, you know, his like shadow,
his alter ego,
yeah, which is like starts with the whiskeys. But he was like surfing the van roof in the Whataburger parking lot after that gig. I'm serious. I remember that one. Because there's also one of the guitar players from the Texas Gentleman, Ryan Ake. I think that it was his first time to come out to one of our gigs. He was young. He was younger than us. So this was 10 years ago.
Yeah. Right? Oh yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah, it was like 2009.
Yeah. So yeah, that would have been about right. Yeah. Those days we were just three sheets to the wind, not giving a fuck at all.
Well, I remember reading an article where it was like, you guys on tour with Lynyrd Skynyrd, and they're like, these young kids are making Lynyrd Skynyrd look like old dudes, you know, that aren't, you know, carrying the torch.
We got in
know?
A fist fight the first night on that tour.
A fist fight?
I swear.
Yeah?
I swear to God, we did. Me and my guitar player, or I'm sorry, me and the bass player, Nick J. And it's pretty infamous amongst a lot of, like, our close friends, because it was the first night, like, we'd just gotten signed to Atlantic Records, and it was the first night of tour opening for Lynyrd Skynyrd and Kid Rock. I'm serious. And it was a big deal, because we had gone from, you know, bar band in Dallas to, like, we're playing in front of 20,000 people. And we're still, you know, 21, 22 years old. Like, we're, you know, just feeling invisible as far as, yeah, like, we're rock and roll. We don't care. It's just the cockiest, arrogant, you know, ignorant, really, too. But at that time, we're just going and blowing and going. And Nick and I had already started kind of building up a lot of, like, inner band just resentment.
Oh, so the fight was between the two of you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, at this point, we'd already kind of had a lot of water under the bridge.
And but it wasn't anything you could address, because you had too much shit going on, right? Like,
yeah, and I mean, we just kind of always were at each other's throats for whatever reason. Like, I still don't quite understand it. But at the time, after the show, we've been... Kid Rock, before the show, actually, had brought over... Jim Beam sponsored this tour, so he brought over a case of Jim Beam. First mistake, dude. That was the freaking spark, because I think I was on some, like, narcoleptic pills, anti-narcoleptic, like, won't let you fall asleep pills.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I mixed that with the Jim Beam and was just mouthy. I remember we're in the after party room with Kid Rock and, like, all of my record label from Atlantic. I mean, we had, like, the heads of the company. They were, because they represented Kid Rock too. So they flew in for this. So everybody's there, and I'm like, just making
where
it
was
out.
This at?
I was Florida. I want to say, like, Tampa. Okay. And we're at the after party, and it's by that point I'm already, like, totally should have been asleep, but I was aided, so I was still awake and, like, not. I unplugged the radio at the party, so it was one of those where the music stops. That literally happened. And that was when I think it was like, all right, we better get going. So we're like, go out and find our keys to the van, and nobody can find them. And everybody's shit-faced. And so we've lost the van keys. It's like, it turns from like midnight to like 2 a.m. and we've still not found our keys. And like the band, I'm, you know, out of my mind. And so then I start yelling at Nick J, and probably just, you know, antagonizing him with verbal, you know, whatever. And he, like, you know, just punches me out, just knocks me out. Like, and he's pretty big dude, burly dude, too. Okay. I mean, like, this dude's pretty, he could, like, yeah.
It's a devastating blow.
He just knocked me out. But the thing was, is that, and I totally deserved it. I mean, it was a little bit of a sucker punch, because I was definitely blacked out. But the label, they all saw it. Kid Rock saw it. Lynyrd Skynyrd saw it. I mean, then the thing was, the funniest part was then the rest of the tour, which was like another 2 weeks, I had a black eye. So like every show on that tour, freaking black eye. Just trying to wear sunglasses and hope that nobody saw it. But I think that was kind of the thing. It's like we were trying to live the rock and roll life, and we were, but we were also like idiots. So we kind of
in your 20s, dude. I mean,
I know, but we're in these situations that now it's like you go on that kind of tour, you really got to show up and you got to do your job and be good. And it's a lot of times for me, I'm like, I don't really want to be jacked like that. I actually feel really guilty if I give it if a crowd like that kind of a show, even like being that Three Sheets to the Wind. But I have, you know, it's the tango that you have with like drinking. It's like sometimes it's gonna bite back, and you know, but when you're on stage, it's not necessarily a good thing, because I mean, that's not a good way to start your tenure.
Did somebody have like a talk with you guys next morning?
I mean,
morning?
It was just, I think that the label was just like, oh, fuck, what did we get ourselves into? These kids are straight up idiots. And I mean, we really were. So I think a lot of the lessons that we learned were hard lessons, you know, but that's kind of, it is what it is, right?
So I mean, are you still rocking the same band?
Oh no. I mean, we're talking like 15 years down the road now. I mean, not really, I guess 10 years going on like 12. We started in 2007. That was the first album. And then the label thing was like 2009 or 2010.
Where'd you do the first one in 2007?
2007 we did in Dallas at the studio. It's downtown, but it's called Bass Propulsion Sound Laboratories. I don't think it's there anymore. It was owned by the guys in that band, Deep Blue Something. They had that song, okay. Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah.
So they were...
Those are Dallas natives?
Yeah. Okay. And so they started that studio. We were in college and just piecing together enough money to do it. And it actually kind of came out and people were really... They were into it. So it changed our lives like really quickly. Like once that album came out and there was a couple tracks that like... radio started playing. It was like, oh man, people are showing up at the shows now. Like we're starting to feel really good, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's kind of bad for a 21, 22 year old kid to be.
Was that the first thing that you'd recorded?
No, I'd recorded more in high school. And,
okay. Where did you grow up?
I grew up moving around. So my parents were transient, but my mom's from San Antonio. My dad's from South Carolina, the Greenville area, okay. South Carolina. They met in Charleston, and my mom got pregnant there. And while my mom was pregnant, they moved to Birmingham, Alabama. So I was born in Birmingham, Alabama. We lived there until I was 12. We moved from city to city mm-hmm. in there every couple of years. So
okay.
I went to a couple different elementary schools. I went to a couple different middle schools and a couple high schools, so two of each. But we moved from Alabama.
Were you playing music then?
No, not yet. I was more into sports and skateboarding.
Yeah.
And we moved up to New Jersey, and like right outside of New York. I mean, we could see the Twin Towers, you know, from like our neighborhood. It was
That's
crazy.
That's a change from Birmingham,
it was insane, and it sucked. I mean, to be honest with you, I was like, I mean... It's hard to make new friends every few years, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, that's crazy.
Do you get to a point where you're just like, why bother
making
new friends?
I did. I got to that point by high school. So, like, when we went up to New Jersey, that was an awesome time because I actually got really into skateboarding and music at that time, and there was a lot of the people that I was hanging out with that were into that stuff, too. So it was really cool. Whereas in, like, Alabama, I was just kind of like... In some ways, there weren't people who were into, like, skateboarding and rock and roll music.
There are now over there at the dojo.
No doubt. No doubt, man. No, for sure. I love those guys down there.
Yeah. So Jersey, the skateboarding had to be sick there, dude.
Yeah, Asbury Park. And that was a huge deal.
Were they
for me.
Cutting down on it at that point, or
no.
was it like a free for all?
It was.
Then?
There, no, it was charged. Like you could pay and go in there, and it was like it was pretty. Yeah, it was like it wasn't. I don't know. It was fun. I loved it. And it was like what.
By the time I started skating street or like in the city, like when we could drive to Fort Worth in Dallas, it was like right at the same time the cops were hot, dude, writing people tickets and.
Yeah.
You know, like really clamping down on.
I mean, it wasn't bad, but I was in middle school. I mean, we were shitheads for sure, but like, it wasn't bad. It was, it was cool. It was actually really embraced up there. I thought like skateboarding seemed like it was, you know, a big deal up there. But then we moved when I was like a freshman. We moved back to Alabama.
So, oh shit!
And then, but only for a year, and then we moved. To Dallas, in a suburb of it, basically called Flower Mound. Mm-hmm. We moved there when I was in 10th, like in between 9th and 10th grade. So I go from, you know, three schools in the last like 3 years, and then I'm like going into a school with 700 people per class. So it's like almost 3,000 people. By the time I got to that school, I was just like, I'm not even trying. And at that point, I would just go to school, and I was a good student and all that because I was kind of a nerd like that. But did all that, and then I would go to play music, and I had a band and stuff, and we would we would write songs and play music.
No, like school band or nothing.
Not at all.
No,
I just wasn't socially involved at the school because it, like I said, it was like going from a small school in Alabama and then a small school in New Jersey, even.
Oh, it's small up there.
Yeah, the school up there was. I mean, it wasn't like tiny, but it was like 1,000 people for the whole school versus like going to like 3,000 people.
Gotcha.
You know, to where. I'd see people I'd never seen before every day, like in the hallways at that school. So it was just kind of like, I just started building a, like having a separate life from that high school.
So were you taking lessons, or how were you learning music?
I learned myself, man. I was like a total self-taught. I'm totally self-taught.
Like from the internet, or just picking up?
From the internet, mostly. Yeah. I mean, when I started playing, it was like getting guitar magazines, like Guitar Player. And those sort of magazines.
They put the tabs in there. Dude, that's
I
how
learned
I learned
to read the tabs, yeah. Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about. Like, the tabs were, like, kind of everything because, like, my grandmother plays piano and she reads and it's brilliant. She can play anything. And I always kind of felt like I was, like, subpar because
not
I didn't
worthy,
read.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to read. I thought that it was boring. I was like, I don't want to read music. Like, I liked the tabs, and so I just anything I was listening to on the radio, I'd get the tabs for. I'd try to learn it, and that's kind of how I taught myself through just learning what other people did, and then over the years of just hanging out with different musicians and studying it, I've learned more of the theory and like the back end side, the mathematical side of like how chords work together and stuff like that, the technical stuff. But yeah, it's, for me, it was all feel at first. Like, just like, what
were you
I'm,
listening to? What were the.
I mean, in freaking eighth grade, seventh grade, I loved Nirvana. I loved heavy stuff too. Like, I was really into like Pantera and Death.
Did you ever see them while you were in Dallas back then?
I didn't, man. I wish. I saw them at the club that they owned, but I never saw them. I never saw them playing shows.
Fucking drum set upstairs. Dude, what a rad spot that place is, dude. Mm-hmm. I haven't been there in years. We went after Dime died when it was like...
Yeah.
It was like a party in the streets. Like, every, like it was just
God, what
insane.
A crazy situation. Playing a show and somebody comes on stage and shoots you. I mean, that's unbelievable to even imagine. Like, the thought is terrifying, you know? Crazy, crazy.
Yeah, that is. I hadn't even thought about that really in years. That, yeah, he was gunned down right.
It's a freaking guitar in his hand.
It's crazy. Is that the way you want to go?
No.
No.
No. I don't want to go at the hands of some lunatic. Are you kidding me?
No.
No.
So heavy stuff like Pantera.
I was really into
like
heavy
hate
stuff.
Hatebreed.
Punk rock. I mean, I wouldn't say Hatebreed, but like. I mean, new metal sounding. You know, I was pretty radio. I was really into MTV and the radio. So whatever was on there, that's what I was kind of watching. And
gotcha.
I was totally just a product of all
like
that.
Like the Alice in Chains and...
Yeah, sure.
Soundgarden.
Yeah. I mean, Korn and stuff
that.
Oh,
Korn.
Even. I mean, I love that stuff when I was 13.
Dude, that first album... was fucking new and different and
but weirdly, I just liked everything. I liked music from a really young age. I just was like, wanted to hear everything and like listen to a lot of stuff. But I mean, at that point, at the 13-year-old point, like that's what I was listening to. Mm-hmm. But my dad's a huge music guy, so we like grew up listening to the Beatles. That's his favorite band. So I love the Beatles now. And they were a huge influence, just subconsciously, that all those years of just like him playing it all the time. But Lynyrd Skynyrd, favorites, you know.
Yeah.
They're still favorites.
Then you got to go on tour with them.
I know, it was pretty wild, man. It really was. It was really crazy. It was a lot of validation, you know, for doing it. It was like, man, I've tried and now here I am doing this. This is like, it's working, you know. It's a crazy feeling. I mean, it really is that wave, it starts to catch. It's like one of the best feelings in the world.
So what kind of bands before you formed?
Well, mostly like trying all different things. Just trying, you know, at first we were just trying to play Metallica songs when I was in middle school.
Were you singing and playing guitar from the get-go?
No, I was playing guitar at first.
Okay.
And was too afraid to be a singer. Yeah, just try like cover bands, playing Metallica and whatever else we're listening to. And then actually kind of got into like the church. And I was, because my parents are both kind of church oriented and they kind of raised us in that way. So like there was a time where that sort of being there and being like, hey, can you play guitar in the band up here? And I'm like, yeah, I'll do it. And it was fun. And
I played drums at church.
I mean, I honestly look back and there was a time where I didn't want to talk about that because like
really?
Because I just don't want to be, I have like, you know, mixed feelings about that stuff too. So I don't really like to be like lumped into a group, you know, and okay. I'm not trying to like raise the flag of the church flag. I'm not, because there's a lot of really good things, but there's also a lot of bad things. And I think that like, I just don't really want to get, like, I kind of want to stand on my own as an individual, you know. So it's one of those topics where you if you talk about it, like, people are like, oh, he's this guy, and it's
dude,
like,
I'll tell you, I played in like, it was like a boy band,
yeah,
for these four brothers. Their dad was the preacher. They were all like, you know, the youth group leader. I mean, it was like four, yeah, you know, beautiful young dudes that all sang harmonies together.
Yeah.
And it was like a bebop band.
Well, I mean,
never would have thought I'd have done that.
But think about how many people you love, like, and respect that's where they got their start singing, in church. Because
yeah,
it's kind of like, it's a forum, and it's a really good forum for, like, getting your feet wet for stuff like
absolutely,
that. Where you're like, you know, oh, that guy can play guitar. Well, put him on stage, you know? Yeah. And I do love that part of it, because it's real community and you're kind of doing stuff together. And I love that element of it.
Dude, we can't go through this conversation without me bringing up the fact that I watched the Waco series on Netflix recently.
I didn't see that yet.
Dude, and I had no idea that Koresh was such a rock and roller, dude. I mean, they showed him just rocking out, playing guitar.
Really?
He had his band.
I need to see
it. I didn't know that.
I need to see it. Yeah, because I've heard a bunch of people talking about it.
It was pretty good. I mean, it was, you know, I was real young back. I mean, at that point, I was like 7 or 8 or something, you know?
So, for the Waco thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? So I was like 9 or 10, somewhere in there. I knew about it. I knew some shit happened.
Yeah.
And I don't know how, obviously, like, how truthful what they portrayed on the TV was, but, you know.
I'll never know.
I definitely didn't know that he was such a rock and roller, dude.
I'm going to watch that now.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so was Charles Manson.
Oh, man.
He was a rock and roll guy, too.
Yeah, he was.
But there's some new series about Charles Manson being potentially tied to
MK Ultra and the CIA.
That was like a shadow doc or something that was put out on YouTube recently.
Really? So I just heard a podcast with a guy named Tom O'Neill who released
that's it. Yeah, yeah. Okay, no, that was what it was. On Elon, it was on
Joe Rogan.
Joe Rogan. I associate Joe Rogan with Elon Musk now.
Dude, that last podcast they did was pretty fucking good.
Yeah,
I didn't know I was an Elon Musk fan.
He's such a computer, man.
He is.
I talk with no...
So much so that he's like going to get something put in his head at some point to plug in.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that's just stoking the religious fears of, like, you know, end times.
It's yeah.
Like we're all going to get the mark of the beast once we all get the... I grew up like totally in that kind of a church where we learn about this stuff, like scary stuff.
See,
like
From the get-go, I thought they were all batshit crazy.
I mean, it is crazy, but at the same time, when stuff starts happening where they're like, yeah, we're going to put computer chips in everybody's brains, it's like, that sounds end times like.
I couldn't think of why he wanted to do it at first, but now I'm like, the more they talk about AI, I'm like, well, shit, somebody's got to be able to communicate with those things. You know, like,
oh, man, he
may have already figured out AI, but he's like, I'm not going to release it until I can plug
in. I just think it's dangerous, man, because it's really dangerous because here's why.
Okay.
Because they're talking about with 5G that the speed at which the communication between a satellite and your phone or satellite and your car is 10 times or maybe even 100 times faster than our brain synapses can send.
Mm-hmm.
So when they start following a child like from a young age with facial recognition and they're basically like in front of an iPad all day and they're starting to build profiles for people And all the data from like the youngest age forever is being stored and kept and then sold. And so you have like this capitalism system where it's like people can buy knowledge about you. And like at a certain point, a lot of knowledge about you. And so the fear for me is when you have a system that's 10 times or 100 times faster than our brain can think that knows you, I mean, they can, you know, there's a lot of manipulation that can be had really, really easily. And I just think that's dangerous to put into the hands of people that we don't even know who they are.
But I mean, it's coming. Like, somebody's going to figure it out. So, like,
right?
You know, I mean, my thought always is like, well, if anybody's going to have it, I hope the people that are fighting for my freedom are figuring it out too.
Well, you know? They like, are. I mean, I know that the U.S. has people thinking about this and working on this, and it's more just kind of, I think at this point, raising awareness that, like, for everyone out there that, like, this stuff is kind of important to be thinking about, like the privacy and the sort of like the hands at who has that information and like, I think that's the fear for me with like the putting the chips in people's brains and stuff. It's just, there needs to be some separation between like freedom. You know, I think that it's less freedom when you start giving that sort of all that information to God knows who, you know, Facebook and all these people. I think that our lives are better because of these things. Like, I do like that they're there.
Yeah, they can be enhancing.
For sure. And I'm really glad that, you know, like a nerd in the middle of nowhere who didn't have a way to find information 20 years ago can now ingest as much information and knowledge as they want. And so it's good in so many ways because it's just going to create, you know, stronger people. But in the wrong hands, I just think that information can be
absolutely
really, and that's where I get kind of like political because I'm like, I don't really want, you know.
Well, my thought is like, I just got to have the benefit of the doubt that the people at the core of this, there's a group of people that are fighting for me to keep doing this right here. Like, there is somebody.
I think so.
Like, and if there's people, like, the bad people are figuring out, I hope to God that there's, like, those people on my side are figuring it out, and I just, the benefit of the doubt, they're fighting for us.
I think they are. You know, I think like, they are. I think
even
they
are. Even if we end up having to give up some stuff, like, and it doesn't seem good, like, deep down, like, benefit of the doubt, it's for the better. Like, that's what my gut instinct is always. Or I try and keep it there.
Well, I think as long as there's people paying attention a little bit, you know, there's got to be people who are paying attention, checks and balances, and just, that's the thing. It's like, don't get too, you know, like, make sure that, I just want to make sure that we're, you know, paying attention a little bit to what's, just what's happening. I mean, it's...
So how did you get all the technical information that you have now to record? You know, like,
I've been doing it for so long. Like, you know, all these albums over the years, I'm always going in and working with somebody who's hitting the record button and setting up the mics. And over the years, I've just picked up little nuances about how to do it through, you know, watching other people. Like... Mm-hmm. Really, from the beginning, we worked with Chris Bell. He was one of the first engineers.
Is he the guy with Deep Blue?
He was the guy that recorded out of Deep Blue, but he recorded like Erykah Badu's really big record, and works with Don Henley, and he works with some really awesome people. He's still around, actually. I saw him like a week ago, but he was one of the first. And then I worked with Jay Joyce in Nashville, who's had countless huge hits. I mean, he's a really big producer. And from him to like Rob Schnaff, who I'm working on this new one with, who Rob is the guy who like engineered and worked on that Beck song Loser.
Come on,
I swear, dude, he worked on that, and he worked on I mean, just so many, like the Toadies big record that had like the
Rubberneck.
Damn. he did that, and he did Elliot Smith's records, bunch of Elliott Smith's records.
I'm
like,
not familiar with Elliott Smith.
He's kind of a songwriter. Awesome, I mean, amazing. And the records are unfathomably good. And then, like, just so many over the years. But, yeah, so all these guys who I really look up to and respect, I just kind of, I mean, I know they know it, but I'm, like, totally watching them. Like, oh, yeah. That's how you set that mic on that, on a piano, you know? That's yeah. how you... And just like over the years, just watching it and like, you know, like, oh, what kind of preamp is that? And just sort of trying to understand. I mean, it's no different than riding a motorcycle and being like, you know, what's the difference between a pan head and a shovel head and an yeah. iron head? You know, at first I didn't get that stuff because I just wasn't raised around it, but I was interested in it. And, you know, just learning the difference between like the swing arm and the...
What I find like most... like maybe unappreciated by most or a lot of people in the recording process is like, and I've never done it on a level where there's like a anything more than an engineer in a band, right? But like having a producer, somebody that's like saying that track was good enough or like, no, we need to do it differently. That's kind of like coercing, getting the best product out of a group.
I don't think it's that crazy though. It's like Tom Fugel. Everybody loved him and his style because it was great style. And yeah. it'd be like, if he was a producer, say making a bike was like making a record, and Tom was the producer, it'd just be like him coming in and be like, no, don't put that, you know, don't put that carb on there, put this carb on there, and yeah. this is how you jet that carb, and this is how you, you know, it's just the tuning, like there's different people who have different opinions on stylistic things, but there's also technical things too, so it's just the whole
yeah, but somebody picture, that sees the whole picture,
the whole
you
picture.
Know, like,
and that's done it a lot. Like yeah. somebody who's made a bunch of bikes or somebody who's made a bunch of records, because then it's like they've gone through a lot of the issues that other people have gone through. So mm-hmm. it's like picking a producer is kind of like, one, you want somebody who technically understands the process of actually engineering a record, mm-hmm. which is the, you know, the frequencies and the mics and the, you know, phasing and all those little things, but then stylistically they have the actual like style that is cool. You're yeah. like, that guy's got cool style. He's not a nerd, you know, right? He's yeah. not a dork. He's like, he's got cool style. Like, so it's kind of a combination of both. And then you're putting your trust in them. Because I mean, when I'm making a record for myself, I just want to bounce off, you know, an idea to somebody. I'm going to play it back and be like, hey, should we sing it in this key or should we sing it in this key? Which one's better for my voice? Like, and get somebody's opinion to be like, oh, your voice is better in that key, so do it there. So finding that person you can bounce those ideas off and actually trust is the mm-hmm. hard part for me, because a lot of times I think I know more than, than the engineer or the other person in the room. So it's hard for me to, like, trust people's opinion. So it takes somebody like Rob for me to be like, that guy knows what's up. And I just know anytime I toss something at him, he's gonna be like,
yeah, you don't have to worry about.
I just know. So in those moments of like, personally, you know, when you get wrapped up in a song and it's, you can't really, you get kind of lost if you get really close and kind of focused on it.
So if that was my biggest problem with this album we did, where I recorded it, I was the engineer, I guess. Then I mixed it. You know, did the math. Like I'd heard it so many times.
And exactly.
I would ask somebody, which I didn't really think about who I was, like, okay, you're here, like, listen to it. And they're like, ah, the vocals are too loud. I'm like, you don't know what you're talking about. Then I'd turn the vocals down, you know? Like,
yeah.
It was tough, man. It was like, I had never.
That's the other thing about going in on a song like that, is that you're zooming in. I mean, you're zooming like microscopic level zoom in.
Oh, I was.
And then you're asking, and then the person who's right next to you is like, you're asking them, and they're looking at it like, oh, whatever.
Okay.
Like they don't even, you know, like your view is like so finite at that point. Like when you've listened to a song 1,000 times, and they're listening to it for the first time, just like, yeah, cool. Well, swipe up. Yeah. You know? Trying to keep that in perspective.
Yeah, it's so how has it changed? I mean, 2008 to now, making the music.
Well, it's changed because, like, you know, then I didn't have any money and I needed to I needed help getting records made. Like I had to have somebody financing it, or we had to go work on the road and make money to pay for it. So it was just a big expense, and it wasn't as easy as today. Like over the years, I've been collecting gear. I've just like anytime I did a commercial for Jack Daniel's last November, and it was a really good, like it was a win for me. So I took, you know, the winnings and bought more equipment. And it's like anytime things like that happen where I do like get a spot on like a TV show, I'll take that and buy a mic or something like that. So over the years I've just been acquiring, and I've finally got enough now to where I can really make records at my house at a great quality level. So it's different now because like I don't really have to. There's less tied to the success of a song.
Yeah.
Because I don't, like, 10 years ago, I really needed that song to do well so that I could make another song. Mm-hmm. If it didn't, then I was kind of, you know.
Do you think it kind of, you obviously get a different product, like, having a lot of time to work on it, as opposed to back then where you're like, we got fucking 4 hours to get this song knocked out.
Exactly.
I mean, I feel like
that pressure.
I feel like that generates some good things. You know, like there's.
I mean, it does, but it also is. It can be hard to like to not get distracted by the pressure and to not get like. I think that instincts are like natural instincts are usually really great, but I think that when you put those sort of pressures and those things onto those instincts, it changes them. And I, like, if I'm working with a band and they come in and they're really, like, if they're really stressed out about a certain thing, it's like, well, let's just do something else. Because you don't really want to make something, like, in a stressful situation. I don't think. I mean, I guess artistically from the outside looking in, that is interesting to kind of see a situation and be like, oh, they were under all this pressure and this and that.
Yeah.
But I don't think it necessarily is the most nurturing for like creativity.
Yeah.
I think it's better when you got like months to make a record and you can just try different things and kind of find that equilibrium in the studio. But like just going in super fast, it can be hard to find that footing.
Yeah.
And that sort of like, 'cause you're making decisions really fast. You have to trust your intuition and your instincts. But if you're like under all these different pressures, it changes things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it does for everybody.
Yeah. Some better, some worse. So you're producing other bands now.
Yeah.
When did that start?
Well, so I was making demos for Northern Lights for after Pardon Me, the album that we did.
So was that a one album deal? Like what happened? What did the name change?
No, it fell apart. It fell apart. It just fell apart.
From that first fight? Like
it was. Well, I mean, the thing is that it was just that we had no idea what we were doing. We didn't really have the counsel on like what we were doing. It was just,
so you didn't have really haphazard.
I mean, look, my managers were, I don't want to talk bad about them because they were shooting from the hip too. I mean, they'd never. They'd never done that either.
Worked with
and
him.
So
okay.
One of them was a firefighter who literally moved mountains and still does. And the other was a radio rep for a label out of LA. So he was in the industry. And the combined, they did a great job. And there was a lot happening. But once it got to that level of like we're playing on late night TV and we're playing opening for these other bands, it was out of like all of our wheelhouse. No one really knew what we were just kind of doing it, you know. And so I think that when you're dealing with $100,000 record, you know, hundreds of thousand dollars record deal, millions of dollars like being spent and moving around, you can't really have a bunch of idiots punching each other out like on the first night of tour. Like it's just, it's too much at stake for all the people who are involved.
Yeah.
And you can't bet
on... Too much liability.
Yeah, you can't bet on that. And so we were... I mean, it's all fun to talk about now, and I got a million stories. Like, that's not even... That's just the tip of the iceberg. But, but it, like, looking back, you know, that's... I don't even know where I'm going with this, but you know, looking back, that's
when it all fell apart. Like the record label.
Well, the album came out. It sold pretty well, actually. Like, I mean, 30,000 records now is incredible. There's a time where that's, you know, nothing, drop in the hat. Like, but at that time, it wasn't bad, and we had you know, all kinds of placements. Like Martin Scorsese used our stuff on Boardwalk Empire, and we were all over NASCAR, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff. And like I said, it was the wave, the feeling was amazing. But you know, I think that I was resistant to like tote the company line and to like go along with creative decisions making. Mm-hmm. Like I was still very like, this is direction that I want to go sound wise and vibe wise, and this is what I'm looking for, and this is where I'm going, like creatively.
And you were getting pushed
and
back.
I was getting, yeah, I was just getting like a totally opposite kind of a direction, and we just never could like sync up on like the vision. And the, you know, they controlled all the cards at that point, and so it just kind of was a stalemate. And it took a few years before I was able to find a lawyer who got me out of the record deal. But it was like, it was just like, I'm a pretty idealistic, principled person, so like I'll dig my feet in too, you know. So they're digging theirs in, like, well, you're not going to release an album, and I'm like, well, I guess I'm not. You know, because I'm not going to go do that or whatever. Wow. And then it just took, you know, like, so it took a few years to get out of that thing. And once we got out of that thing, the band was pretty much beaten up and broken down and broke and done.
Were you guys playing at all during that time?
It slowed down. I mean, it went to where it was hard to continue touring on the same album. It was like, you know, we're just kind of in this loop that wasn't really going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And life was hard. I mean, a couple of dudes had babies, and they had pressures at home, and it just fell apart. You know, just couldn't withstand that, like, that pressure and that heat, you know? And so the band fell apart, and finally kind of got out of the record deal.
What was the band's thought on it? Were they like, dude, just do what they want. Let's keep going.
Nobody wanted to do.
Really?
Nobody wanted to do it. They were trying to push like pop country production and stuff. Like, I remember they were like, sent me to meet up with Jason Aldean's producer. And I was like, there's just no way, just, man. I'm sorry. I can't do it. Yeah. Like, I cannot go that direction. Like, I'm not going to do it. I'll hate it. And I have nothing against Jason Aldean. It's music. That's cool, man. All good. I'm just saying, for me, that's not what I'm trying to do. So, like, it was just a creative thing. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It was just a creative vision difference. And I think that
did you see that coming? Did anybody like warn you before you struck that first deal? Like,
of course they did.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's one of those things where it's hard to know the right thing to do when you're looking at, like, you know, getting flown to New York and picked up by a limo and taken to the 51st floor on the Avenue of the Americas, and you know, and you're like meeting with, like, I met like some delegate from, I met Lior Cohen, and the night I met him, which he now runs like Google, but he was the head of Warner Brothers at the time. And I met him, and I was just like a freaking redneck kid, you know, just like meeting this dude who controls a $1 billion
in those
company.
Buildings you were staring at as a kid from Jersey.
So yeah, it was hard to know what to do. We're all in. Everybody in my camp was just kind of in over their heads. Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I really look back at it fondly at this point. It's all good. It's just making records now. It's like this last one. I mean, I started it all here at the house, and just kind of like would roll into the room in my pajamas and like kick on the drum machine and like smoke a doobie and just bliss out and make music that I liked. And then called up Rob, who I became friends with through a creative consigliere, Scotty Diablo, introduces us. And then we meet up in LA, one real quick trip. And I'm like, man, I really like this guy. He's a cool hang, you know, Rob. And then just like, I'm going to take these tracks that I did here, and we're just going to add this guy. And now it's like, it's so organic and like real, and just feels like it's happening without any sort of pressure like that, you know? But it's still a producer that makes records that are the biggest ones in the world. So it's like, still feel like I'm like operating at that high level, but just doing it on my own terms and sort of doing it in a way that feels natural and like something I can do for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and, I'm not, and keep loving it, because that's the thing. It's like, that's the hardest thing is like to keep loving to play, because it's not easy, man. And I know, you know, like going on tours can be brutal.
Yeah.
And it really is most of the time. It's brutal. just the what it requires, and you know, when you party like we do, it really can. So it's,
well, I had to quit drinking like 5 years ago.
I've been through that too. You know, yeah,
serious.
Yeah.
Well, now you're producing other people though.
Yeah. So no, like totally.
You, so you I did. Moved on.
So
to,
I started by I was making demos for the band back in the day for Atlantic, for the second record that never happened with them. But I was making.
Oh, coming up with ideas that you wanted, and they
back
were like,
then I was I was like making recordings, showing them, and that was like that 2 year period where they kind of held us and we kind of had a stalemate. I'm sending them music, they're just kind of ignoring it, and through that process of making demos, like I learned how to run Pro Tools and how to like set up a band and just do a 4-track recording. And so that was the beginning of me actually like engineering records and stuff. And then I think at that time, a friend of mine, actually specifically Joshua Jones, he runs KHYI The Range in Dallas. It's a country Americana, mostly Texas stuff. It's cool. He comes over actually to my house, and he sees me like doing this stuff, and he's like, you'd be a good producer. And he was like, I want you to produce something. So he hooks me up with this band called the Bigsbys. They're from East Texas. I don't think they're around anymore, but they had won a Shiner Records deal. Okay. Record deal. So I go in with them. They're like the first band that I'm producing outside of my own stuff. And
so you go into a whole new studio.
I go over to Matt Pence's studio in Denton, Texas, called the Echo Lab. So I go over there with this band, and Matt's doing mostly all the smart work, the intelligence stuff, like setting the mics, you know, EQing it, making it sound amazing. And I'm more of like the personnel and songwriter coach, you know.
Like the producer. Like,
yeah, like going like, let's speed this up, let's slow this down, let's change this key, let's make this bridge, the chorus, you know, just those kind of things, the sort of whatever. So that record came out, and it was okay. Like, it did well, but it didn't like blow up or anything. I don't want to disparage it, because I really honestly don't know what happened with them, but they are no more.
But enjoyed that process?
But the process was like, okay, I felt like I could be good at this. Like, I could use the stuff that the songwriting stuff that I know to like help other people.
Yeah.
And so then I, you know, just started kind of doing that little here and there with different things. And I guess when it really, really kind of hit was when, before Nikki Lane, who's my partner now, before she and I got together, we were friends for years. We'd met at Bandit Town in North Fork, California, through Jen McMillan, who's a good friend of ours for a while now. It's crazy. But we met there. We became friends there. We ended up cutting a song together, To Love Is to Fly. And this is all before we were like seeing each other romantically or whatever. And so.
You cut that song first?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did.
Wow.
And then So where that kind of all met was we've both kind of gotten out of relationships and we're like on tour, we're kind of talking after that song had been out for a little while. And we're both gonna be in Washington, D.C. area at the same time. I think she was playing there and I was on tour. And I'm on my tour, I'm out like up in like the Carolinas. And the next couple dates that I had got canceled. The band that we were opening for canceled. So I'm like, shit, well, she's already up there. I might as well, I'm just gonna let the band head home and I'm just gonna jump in a car and just meet them, you know? So I drive up there, it's right around Halloween. We spend Halloween in New York and kind of like, that's when we first started kind of like romantic, like flirting with the ideas and everything of being together. And at the same time, I was like, you know, when you're done with this tour, because she was going to keep going around the country after this New York thing and during Halloween, I was like, you should come to Dallas and we'll record some stuff for you. Like, just come check it out, you know, if you're trying to make a new record. And so they came through and we did a few tracks and it went pretty well. And I think she ends up going on to make a record with another guy in New York who it just didn't turn out. And so they'd spent their record budget and they're like, oh, you know, what do we do? And she was kind of in a fix.
Like it was that bad, they just were not.
And at the same time, I was like, you know, come down here and try recording some stuff. I'll put together, like, I'll get the Texas Gentlemen, who were kind of the studio backing band at the time that I was using all the time. And I was like, we'll get them in. Matt Pence will, you know, help us engineer and we'll make these tracks. And so we did a couple tracks just on a whim, like, and the label loved it. And it became Highway Queen, the album. We ended up just finishing it out. So it was like, that was the first one where I think that was like a big production.
Yeah.
Like a lot of different people involved, a lot of different energies and all that. And so that was when I think it was like, all right, this is really, I'm doing records that are kind of doing well. So more people are starting. It's a trust thing, really, the production thing. Because it's like somebody just being like, I trust this guy to help me make a really killer record. So I think that it's won over by just making records. So I'm just trying to keep making them. I made one for a guy named Jeremy Pennell out of Kentucky. It's a pretty classic country sounding, really cool. That's going to be coming out here in a few months. And then I worked with this guy, Josh DeSchur. And that's more like indie rock, and that'll be coming out in the next few months too.
So lots of different styles, really.
Yeah. And then did some. I did a track for Shiny Ribs not too long ago, and just kind of, you know, local stuff and friends around Austin now that I'm kind of working.
Has that picked up in the last couple months where people were like, "Well, here, let's."
What happened was actually I have friends in the advertising world. So through just playing and doing stuff over the years, I've met some really close friends that have become, that are like executives at different ad firms. And one of them being Havas, which is a French company that has a bunch of different offices all over the world. They, the Havas Annex in Chicago, one of my really good friends is like an executive producer there. Her name's Joy Mitkinson. She kind of worked with me on some whiskey stuff. We've kind of worked on branding this company called Stolen. And so we got that out, started doing that. She kind of left that company and started going working at Havas. And so I've kind of jumped in now doing music supervision and production for those guys.
Awesome.
Which is like been a lifeline for real. I mean, because all of my gigs were canceled, and so this has kind of been a lifeline through this time. Right now, is just working on a campaign for Camel. So
Camel,
yeah,
mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah, so and it's really tricky, you know, the tobacco. They can't you can't talk about it. It's really tricky. So just because it's the advertising world, it's
they've got so much invested in it.
Well, no, just legally, like those companies, the tobacco companies have a hard time just, you know, they can't advertise, period. Yeah. You know, so I'm not, this is not like a, you know, advertisement. This is what I've been doing. And the Jack Daniels thing was another situation. It was crazy because my friend, Sean Ellis, this is a guy that I was hanging out with in college. He's an art student and just really, really good friend of mine. We love to rage. And he ends up becoming a creative at another ad agency in Chicago that works with Jack Daniels. And so we ended up kind of like getting this track on this international campaign for Jack Daniels, and it was just like, you know, those kinds of things have been.
So how does that, is that like a flat pay, or is that kind of like music where if ad works and they keep using it, do you get more?
It's all changing these days because it's all just, everything is changing and it's not the same. And I think, you know, it's just not the same as it used to be. Like, I think that.
I don't even know how it used to be.
I'm trying not to divulge everything you know, this stuff is tricky. But it's because I'm not on a record label, because I actually own my own stuff, mm-hmm. and I started my own label. And so when a company like that needs a song, like, they don't have to jump through any hoops. You know, they're talking straight to me. So when I'm talking to them, we can do this. And so it's been very advantageous to be independent. It's been like, all I can say is I've made more money independent through few deals than I was ever given when I was on a record deal. Bigger than my whole advance.
Wow.
Like these, and so it's like, it's from the outside, people are like, you're independent, you know, they assume things. And like, I think that things are gonna change in the next few years because a lot of the way that those big sort of ad agencies and stuff, and in films and television too, the way that they want to interact with licensing music and stuff is very different than in the older times. Like, it's like, you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah,
like the labels sometimes make it impossible for the
yeah. Well, the just like they wanted you to do something different when they're like, oh, you want to put this in a movie? Hey, put this in there because we're trying to push this.
Well, they can do that. I mean, if it's a huge conglomerate, you know, if it's a big Warner Brothers project, for sure they can kind of include their own stuff, which, why wouldn't they? But no, I mean, more like if you're, okay, say you're making a commercial for your thing and you want to use a song and you're to open your podcast, mm-hmm. and you're like, I want to use this song by Jonathan. Well, like if it was on a label, then you got to call this guy in New York that doesn't give a fuck about your podcast. And it's going to be like, no, it's going to be $10,000 to use that track.
Yeah.
And you could literally call me and I'd be like, dude, I want to let you use it, but I don't control the thing. Like, we have to let this guy.
Yeah, he's.
So that's, I think for, you know, people who are trying to license music and stuff, sometimes that's what they're running into too. And they're just like, I don't want to deal with calling this guy and having him blow me off and then charge me.
So I reached out and tried to figure that out because I do these things called road shows, right? Just record on my phone on the trips, like as things happen, flat tires, batteries, switches, traffic, whatever it may be. And then I put music in with it.
Yeah.
And I'd started 3 years ago just going to Florida. Didn't really. The idea just kind of like came about, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I use a bunch of music that I like to listen to, a lot of Lynyrd
Skynyrd. Yeah, it's cool.
And after it, you know, the show grew to a certain point, I was like, fuck, I need to like, surely this can't be legal, right? So I go through the hoops, I find a lawyer out in LA actually, and like figure it out, and it's a lot of money. It is a lot of money.
Yeah.
So then people started hitting me up, they're like, how are you putting your podcast out with those songs on it? Because every time I load one up, it gets taken down. I'm like, I have no fucking clue. But what is that? I mean,
well, there's content recognition software.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it's
somehow I'm just getting past that.
I don't know how you are, honestly. I don't know enough about
because I played
the
your
podcast
music.
World. I personally don't. Like I said, I own the stuff. I own most of my stuff now.
Even the early stuff, pardon me?
I don't own that. Yeah. I'm probably never gonna have control over that. But the other stuff that I'm doing, I do. And so I don't necessarily, like if it's a film or something like that, of course I'm going to be like, please go through the normal, you know, have somebody that can help sort of administrate that publishing side of things. But yeah. I don't go after, like I'm not trying to go after, like I think it's good that you're playing this stuff. I wouldn't want
to
stop you.
Well, see, and that's the bands that I've talked to, they're like, no, that's awesome.
Yeah,
that
I mean.
Like, but at least put it, put somewhere on there that like the name so that people can figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, it's, people can figure it out if they really want to, they can figure it out. But, you know, I don't know. I just think that, I'm not saying that all record deals are bad, and I don't want to come off like I am, because honestly, I would do one, but I think that the thing is about it is getting, just knowing what you're doing.
What would you say to a young group that's like, that's flirting with that idea, thinking that maybe they, because most people, musicians I know now, are not after a record deal, you know?
I think they have to, well, the thing about the record deal is that the distribution channels are still controlled by key players. Like, and a lot of the gatekeepers that are going to let your stuff through to the bigger audiences are unlocked with a record label or a team that knows how to unlock those doors. And so it would be foolish to think that you could do everything on your own. Like, you got to have a team, and that's a big part of it. But finding, I think the biggest part is like finding counsel when you're young and you don't, and you're just going into it. It's like, find someone that really can tell you what's going on and listen to what they're saying.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, somebody can be telling you the truth and you just don't want to hear it. You know, that's all. Well,
if it doesn't fit your narrative.
But I think that the record deals can be really, really good, man. I mean, the more people that are working for you as far as trying to get your music out there, the better. Yeah. It's like, it's going to help. But it's just knowing what you're getting into.
Well, how do you feel about the streaming? Like,
I mean, it's hard to fight. Like,
I mean, how
it's
do
one
you
of those
sell
things
music these days?
You can't really. I mean, it's hard to fight it because it's so convenient. I mean, I use it because it's so convenient. It works. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not going to try to go back to a time when, you know, I'm glad that it's there, but it's the hardest part for me, honestly, is that people are listening to music on the worst devices.
Yes.
Nobody listens to music on good equipment anymore. And yeah. I just like, that's one of the things I really like want to like raise the banner for is like, get a good set of speakers in your house and get a vinyl, you know, get something that, because if you're just listening to a song out of your iPhone or out of your laptop that was designed to be paper thin, it's like not giving music a chance to actually give you an experience that is built to give, like, because it's coming out of these devices that don't have good sound. I mean, people used to buy, you know, big speakers for their house, and they'd have record players, and records are so much more data in them than an MP3. I mean, as far as like the quality, it'd be like watching a film on your big screen that's high def versus, you know, a VHS, you know, or something from, you know, a home video setup, where it's like the quality is missing these days. And like, we spend all this time, you know, recording and like getting these perfect sounds so it can actually give you an experience, like, yeah, where you are engulfed by it and sort of gives your mind somewhere to sort of hang out. I mean, that's what music can do. It's like, the best. It's spiritual.
Yeah.
But it's hard to experience it if you're just listening through these.
It was insane when I did the mastering for our album. It was like, there's like 5 different masters for each song for all these different applications. It was like, you know, when I first heard it on the cell phone, I was like, wait a second, what the fuck, man? That's totally different than what I'm hearing through these
speakers.
I know,
but you have to test that now. I mean, like, camera.
Yeah, it used to be, you go, like, I got in my dad's Jeep. When I first, my first approach was,
that's
like,
still the best.
My dad's Jeep's got a great sound system.
The car is still good. The car is by far the best place to listen to music, I think, in average, just if you were to, like, look at what most people are listening to, that's the best place. Because it's enclosed. So it's a tight little space that can be, you know, the acoustics are good in there. Yeah. And most new cars and any car that's come out in the last like 20 or 30 years has a good system in it. Yeah. But that's just one thing that I feel like, because it's like watching a movie. If you're not watching, you know, if you watch it on a big screen versus watching it on an iPhone, it's like...
Or going to the movie theater.
It gives you that experience that music is built for.
Yeah.
And that kind of like not really, I don't know, I think it's lacking these days. Because everybody's, I'm not trying to knock it, but because we've all got these Bluetooth devices that are kind of rinky-dink.
Yeah.
Like, it just diminishes the...
Absolutely, the amount of time and effort that goes into it. And then
or just the experience. Like, there can be a whole other experience that can be had, like, from it. Especially with, like, hi-fi stuff, where you got, like, the tube equipment and the speakers that were designed for it and stuff like that. Yeah. So it can be really cool.
Yeah, things are different, man. Things are different. So this new album that you're working on, what you just released, I mean, recently, the video.
Just did a couple tracks, yeah.
Was that something that you did just recently, or how long have you been working on that?
Well, I recorded that track with Rob about a year ago.
Yeah.
So I had it last summer, but just decided to release it because of the quarantine, because I felt like it was, the song's called Underground Forever.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a response to some of the stuff that's going on, like, that I was talking about earlier with the data and facial recognition and this sort of like surveillance state. And it was kind of about that. But then once the virus thing hit, I was like, this is actually, I felt like it gave it even another layer of the onion. So I wanted to put it out.
Yeah.
So Nikki and I, along with one of my other friends here in Austin, filmed that. Like right as the lockdown was happening.
What it looked like.
Right when it happened, yeah. We were just kind of going out at sunrise and filmed it all.
Oh, in the morning.
We filmed most of the downtown stuff in the morning. And then like either it was magic hour, you know, either morning or dawn or dusk we were filming.
Yeah.
For a couple weeks.
Took a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah, because we were just doing like an hour or two a day. So it wasn't like, so we'd get a couple of things and then go back and get a couple of things and just kind of, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like roaming around downtown Austin in an Uncle Sam.
Which with a gold shovel?
With a golden shovel. Yeah. Like, what the fuck? It's absurd.
Yeah, and it was like a ghost town. It was really cool that you did it. I mean, one other time without pulling a fuck ton of permits, can you get the streets shut down like that?
I know. That's what I wasn't even really thinking about it like that.
And really?
I didn't necessarily care if there were people on the streets or not during the video. Like I honestly didn't. It wasn't like
product, was there anybody in there?
There's some people in there. You can see that there's like buses and there's people walking down the street. I mean, not a lot, but but you can see we weren't trying to like hide that per se. I mean, it was more about sort of like trying to find and like digging to find the key. You know, that you can't find, you're not going to necessarily find the answer to what's going on through certain things. I think that people are going to have to start, and we all are, and like, that's kind of the things we're all starting to kind of have to dig right now to find like peace. I mean, it's a little bit of a chaotic psychological test, this whole thing. And I think that's kind of the reason of the underground idea is sort of like, I don't know, not trying to find the answers through what we're being told in these channels, these voices,
mass media outlets.
You know, I don't think they're necessarily telling the truth. I think we're gonna have to go and look for that. You know, and that's kind of that. I wanted people to be able to interpret it the way that they would interpret it. But I definitely was also, you know, playing on the idea of like death and underground. You know, you're almost like digging a hole.
Digging a grave.
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of like also in there. So there's all these little themes that I was kind of, you know, thinking about. But the American dream is something that I was kind of, because it's a dream. The video is a dream. And just showing that, kind of trying to portray that, I'm watching these images on the TV, and then the dream, you're waking up in this outfit that you saw on the TV. It's like the things that you're seeing are subconsciously embedding themselves into people. And so it's like we really need to be careful about what we're
taking in.
And that's sort of the idea of like kind of going underground and sort of being a little bit more.
When I came down here, I felt like I came above ground. When I went into HEB, I was just like, whoa, damn.
It's really crazy.
It really is.
It's really crazy because the left side, the liberals are saying that they're just, every day is about how bad this is and how many people are dying and how bad Trump's doing. And then the right is just acting like nothing's wrong at all. And just going, I mean, two polar opposite truths
mm-hmm.
being displayed at the same time. And I mean, I kind of think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. You know, like I think but nobody's really, it's just really hard to know what is going on. And that's why I think it's wild that you see, you know, in certain areas where nobody's worried about it, and everybody's just kind of hanging out.
Like, in one area, you're looked at funny if you have a mask on, and then another area, you look funny if you don't have a mask on.
Yeah.
It's like, and this just happened on a motorcycle ride, you know, like.
Yeah, and then you've got celebrities and people in the media being like, look at this fucking idiot that doesn't have a mask on. And it's like, I mean, it's intense psychological, you know, test. And then you got other people on the other side saying, look at these idiots. And just like, man, we are like under a lot of psychological warfare, man, right now. And it's just hard to know what the truth is.
Yeah. I mean, where do you look for, like you personally, when you're like, I need some solid news, what's your go-to?
I mean, I have been watching PBS, actually. I've been watching PBS. They started doing this... they started kind of having a nightly news thing. And I feel like it's pretty boring. Like it's just,
I feel like anybody that's going to present just the fact.
It's really pretty boring. It's like, it's not very like sensationalized.
Yeah.
It's not sensationalized at all. And so that, and I've been reading this Morning Brew. It's like a newsletter that I get through email. And it's kind of like a condensed thing with different links to different things, and I really like that. It's totally unbiased as well.
That sounds
amazing. I don't like to have to look through, like, oh, I'm watching this and now I gotta look through this lens to find what's, you know, it's just like, I'm just not gonna watch that. I don't know, it's hard not to get too caught up in all that stuff. So for me, because I'm also a person that wants to know what's going on.
Yeah, I'm interested.
Very interested. Yeah, I definitely follow the news like very closely. And so that's the catch-22 of the video. It's like I'm not really doing a good job of doing what I said I was going to do or what I'm telling.
I mean, maybe you're just showing from experience. Like,
always think to myself, like, if I don't pay attention, nobody, who else is? Like, because everybody just thinks, oh, whatever, you know, I'm not going to worry about it, you know. Well, it's like if everybody does that, then who's paying attention? Like mm-hmm. That's what keeps me up at night.
I don't know, man. I think that's a good note to end on, dude.
All right, if you say so.
Hey, I appreciate it, dude.
Yeah, anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We literally went an hour and a half, and I don't know that I mentioned motorcycles once. I think he did. He talked about the motors, trying to compare it to music. And I don't know, dude. He has this bitch in Ironhead out on the front porch. We didn't talk about that. We didn't talk about how he got connected with, like, he played the first Giddy Up. You know, besides just being a badass musician, he's got ties to this motorcycle world that I find myself in. So, I don't know. We'll have to go back and talk to him again, and I look forward to that. Go check out his music on iTunes. It's really amazing. YouTube, the music video that we talked about, you can find all that at JonathanTylerMusic.com. So, bitchin', thank you, thank you, thank you. Dude, let's go ride some fucking motorcycles.